You're quite loud in my head today.
Good.
The CMU podcast in association with 7Digital.
This week, Spotify, European copyright reform, agent of change, and the Wu-Tang Clan. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. I have with me Chris Cook, who is the business editor of CMU. That intro, I thought, sounded quite both boring and mysterious. But
the intro at the start or the intro you've just done?
The intro right at the start.
The this week,
because I had to say European copyright reform, and that sounds quite boring.
Quite a lot of syllables in
there. But agent of change, that sounds mysterious.
Unless you know what it is.
Well, unless you know what it is, which we have discussed it before, so people probably do. But I was just noting that.
If you don't know what it is, well, that's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Because at some point in this podcast, we're going to unveil the truth.
And I just wanted to flag it up because people might have just heard that intro and gone, well, that sounds, I don't know whether to carry on listening because it sounds both boring and mysterious. I assure you that none of it will be boring. Some of it might be mysterious, but that is just due to an administrative error.
Is mysterious a good thing or a bad thing? I'm assuming boring is a bad thing.
Boring's bad. Mysterious, people are intrigued, that's not a bad thing.
So the mysteriousness of the agent of change compensates for the boringness of the name European Copyright Review, but not the content.
Well, that's what we're going to find out.
Well, the content of the review might also be boring, but our discussion of it will be enlightening, educational, informative, and entertaining. So
yes,
that's something to look forward to in the second segment. Is that what we call them? The second part of this podcast. We don't do chapters. Can you still do chapters in podcasts? In the early days of podcasts, that was a thing.
You can do if you can be asked, so, which I can't. So, well, we don't.
if we had chapters, people could go, oh, that sounds a bit boring, and skip a whole section.
If you
really
listen
easily
on Mixcloud, we have chapters.
Oh, right.
But I discovered this week when I thought, oh, I just want to skip to something on
What were you wanting to skip from last week's podcast?
Obviously I didn't want it to skip because I don't listen to it on Mixcloud in full, but I just wanted to check how it worked, I think. And I discovered it doesn't work.
Oh, right.
So for months I've been typing in all this track, all the, you know, time codes for different sections of the podcast, and it doesn't work.
No, that's not skipping on Mixcloud. No, it never has been skipping. Because if there was... I'm going into Mixcloud licensing now. Because if there was music in it, then they're not allowed to skip from track to
track.
Well,
why do they get you to put the times in?
It's a PPL thing. It's a licensing thing. It's the music industry's fault, not Mixcloud's fault. I'm saying that because Mixcloud, I know, whereas the music industry's too big that they can't...
Do you know how long I've been wasting my time doing that? For a thing that I'm sure no one ever looks at.
But if you have music, I think you're meant to do that for various licensing reasons. Anyway, Mixcloud... We don't, but that's our choice, not Mixcloud's choice.
But if you don't do it, Mixcloud's all like, oh, you haven't finished putting your track up. Bloody Mixcloud. Sorry, thank you very much for the award nomination earlier this year.
So go and listen to the podcast on Mixcloud.
Yeah, you can't skip chapters.
Well, no, but it tells you where the next pick starts.
It lets you put in chapter, like say whether it's track or chapter.
But you can scroll. So you could manually skip and say, oh, look, this information is telling me that, I don't know, 13 to 27 minutes is a really boring copyright bit. So then I can manually move the scrolling thingy.
I don't think it tells you when the time's...
Oh, does it not?
No, it just gives you a list of things that are in it, but not, you know, when they come.
So the conclusion of this long conversation is...
You know when I said the podcast sounded like it might be boring this week? Just...
But the good
we've started badly.
The good news is,
yeah,
that even if you're listening to this on Mixcloud, you can't skip stuff. So
just carry on.
You're in here for the long haul. In fact, you will find, take my word for this, even the stop button won't work during this podcast. So you're stuck with us for the next 48 minutes discussing all of these exciting things like Spotify and Wu-Tang Clan and Agent of Change.
And the European Copyright
Review. So you went to ACM this week.
I did, and you went to BIM.
Which is the... what does ACM stand for?
The Academy of Contemporary Music.
The Academy
of Contemporary
Music.
Did you look up what BIM stands for?
BIM?
Yeah.
BIM stands for the British and Irish, because Dublin does not want to be considered to be something British. It's the British Isles, of course, but the British and Irish... I can't remember what the end's for. I know what it is.
One of them's got to be music.
I know what it is. It's the British...
Metropolis.
Well, the funny thing...
Megalodon.
It's the British and Irish Modern Music Institute. So technically it should be BIMI. But of course it used to be the Brighton Institute of Modern Music. And now they're all over the place.
Yeah, but they picked the new acronym. Well, not the new acronym, but they picked what the letters stand for. So they could... Why did they get that wrong? Because, how did it all go so wrong?
Well, because
him?
The I was Institute, wasn't it? But what B word could say United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland and Ireland? Actually, they're now in Germany, so it doesn't even work because they're setting up in Berlin. But anyway, I had a really nice time at BIM, or BIMI, or whatever you want to call them. Or BIMI, what would it be? Big Me. Big Me.
The British and Irish.
And German.
Also Germany.
Music Modern Institute. Anyway.
Big Me, that's almost Big Me. No, that's not good, is it?
I talked about the dissecting the digital dollar report.
Did you?
And it was very interesting. And they asked
was it?
Well, I was interesting, obviously, because I was talking about digital licensing, and that's always interesting. We also had the masterclass this week. That was also very interesting. I'm just saying all the stuff I've done this week has been really good.
What did you do this week that was rubbish? I mean, you've been at lunch all afternoon, and I imagine you're quite drunk.
Well, so, as you know, I don't drink.
Well, that's what you say, but...
I have to say, the Great Escape Christmas lunch was actually better than the UK Music Journalist Christmas lunch. The company was great at both, but the food was a lot better at the Great Escape Christmas lunch. We were meant to be talking about our experiences at ACM and BIM.
Yeah, I'm not sure anyone really wants to hear about the free lunches you've been given.
Can I have a very quick moan about the really nice free lunch I was given yesterday? Well, it wasn't really nice.
Did they give you fish?
It wasn't. Well, there was fish, but it wasn't compulsory. So that wasn't the problem.
Right.
The problem was, rather than everyone getting a plate with your Christmas dinner on, like happened today at the Great Escape Christmas lunch, it was all in dishes in the centre of the table and you had to help yourself.
Yeah.
But they all started at one end of the table and I was sitting at the other end of the table. So by the time they reached me, the vegetables were cold and the turkey was all gone. So I helped myself to some cold veg and I said to the guy, the waiter guy, there's no turkey. So we'll get some more. But it took 20 minutes to get more turkey. So after 10 minutes, I just sort of said, I'm not going to get any turkey. So I ate my cold vegetables. And then 10 minutes later, the turkey arrived and I ate the turkey. So the actual food part of the occasion wasn't brilliant. But I talked to lots of great people from across the music industry. So that was fun. The Great Escape Christmas lunch was fun. Talking about dissecting the digital dollar at BIM was fun. What the hell were you doing at the acoustic...
I went
Church of Music or whatever.
I went to the Academy of Contemporary Music,
which is in Guildford. BIM is in Brighton. Well, the BIM I went to was in Brighton. They've got a brand new place right in the middle of Brighton.
We're never going to get out of this intro, are we?
Tell me about ACM in 30 seconds and then I'll tell you about Spotify.
All right, deal. I went to the Academy of Contemporary Music to talk to some of their music business degree students about how I got into the music industry.
How did you get into the music industry?
As I told them, this is more of a cautionary tale than a useful tale because the route I took to get into the music industry was really stupid. But the Academy of Contemporary Music is a very exciting and interesting place. I went and saw all their amazing rehearsal rooms and recording studio and, like, the best bit, like two drum tuition rooms, which is just like a classroom with a drum kit at the front and then loads of rows of drum kits.
Have you set your drums up in your new house yet?
Yeah, I have.
So
yeah.
You felt inspired to do some drumming?
Well, not enough to actually go and do some, but... I did think, wow, if I'd have known about this place when I was 18, life would have been very different.
So did you tell them that when you email Chris at CMU and ask if you can have a job and he says, oh, that's really interesting, and then doesn't get back to you for 6 months, send a second email?
I didn't tell them about the massive length of time it took me to actually come and work for CMU after I'd been told I could have a job. But
we were busy. I had all those Christmas lunches to fit in, to be responding to your emails.
Not till April.
Well, I had to recover from all the Christmas lunches.
I'd forgotten about that.
The fact it took several months for me to get round
period of time
to hiring you.
When I could have been doing some very fine work for you, but no.
Yeah, think of all the missing CMU daily stories there were in the 6 months it took us to hire you. Anyway... This is the longest intro ever. I thought, Bill, perhaps we should just wrap up the podcast there. But we did promise Spotify and Agent of Change and Copyright and Wu-Tang Clan.
I'm sure we've done everything everyone came here for. Let's just run through these really
quickly. I'm feeling bad now about dissing the UK Music lunch because it was a free lunch. Why am I moaning?
But I didn't get a free lunch. I was in Guildford.
You were invited. You just already committed to go and brag about your many experiences in the music industry to a bunch of aspiring, young, future talent type people.
I didn't brag. I told them what I did and then said, and you could do exactly the opposite of that and it would probably do me much better. Anyway, Spotify, windowing. Windowing is back. And this time it's personal.
That makes no sense whatsoever.
It's the tagline for windowing. It's the way everyone knows it.
So, windowing.
Yeah.
We all know what windowing is.
Yeah.
So this is where artists have the option of releasing their new music in different places at different times. So this is basically Spotify insist and always have insisted ever since day one that if you want your music on Spotify, obviously Spotify has the premium £10 a month package and it has the free ad-funded package. And when you provide your content to Spotify, you have to be in both. You can't just be in one or the other. So if you want your music on there, you're all in or you're all out. And of course, this, when Taylor Swift was having her little fallout with Spotify, this is exactly what it was about. It's not that Taylor Swift is down on the concept of streaming. It's that she's down on the concept of free-to-access streaming. She doesn't like the idea that people who aren't paying any money at all can get complete on-demand access to her music at any time. And so what Taylor Swift says to the streaming services, was that a year ago, 2 years ago, 18 months ago?
It was a period of time ago.
Whenever it was that Taylor Swift was having her little down on the streaming spat, I think it was about a year ago. And what she's saying is, if you're on-demand only, so like Apple Music or audio as was, because audio obviously only had personalised radio on free, then have my music and allow your paying subscribers to stream my lovely songs. But I don't want to be on free. And so because Spotify say, well, you're either all in or you're all out, Taylor Swift says, well, I'll be all out. And a number of labels and artists and managers in the last year, 18 months, have been starting to say, well, for big name artists, surely Spotify should start offering this windowing option that they give their new music to premium users before freemium users. So Spotify would offer the option, you put your music in there and you say, okay, well, I want it to go to your premium subscribers the day of release. So the same day it comes out on CD and download, then make it available to your premium users. But please hold it back for a month, 2 months, 3 months, a day, whatever, until your freemium users get it. And that is what people are asking for. I say people, you know, I say some labels, some managers, some artists. Spotify have always been really resistant of this. They've always been very much, oh, our free offer is how we upsell premium. You know, the fact that we have this really good free ad-funded service is how we get so many people signed up and then we upsell them to £10 a month. That's why we have way more premium subscribers than everywhere else. If we start fiddling around and messing with the free service, we'll screw everything up. And then it'll all fall to pieces. So we're not doing this. But this week...
Well, that's all changed. Because we've had a couple of big windowed releases of late. So well, Adele's new album is not on any streaming services.
Yeah, so she's... I mean, so the Adele situation actually is different.
It is different.
That she's windowed off streaming entirely. So she's not just not on Spotify and Deezer because they have the free level. She's not on Apple Music either, even though Apple Music only has the premium version.
So she's doing... She's done a full window.
A full window.
In that you can purchase her album, but you cannot stream it in any form. And then Coldplay last Friday released their new album and it also was not on Spotify and Deezer and places that provide freemium streaming, so much like Taylor Swift. And as a result of that, because this is becoming sort of a bigger thing now, and whenever it happens, Spotify gets a load of negative press, which is not good for Spotify. So it seems that Spotify might now be kind of shifting in its opinion. The Wall Street Journal, which is usually fairly reliable on these things, reckoned that execs at Spotify were now planning to experiment with allowing people to have content on premium but not freemium early next year and just see how that goes and if it works.
Yeah, and if it does screw up premium.
Screw up everything.
And the Wall Street Journal sources, they were saying that execs at Spotify had said to labels, yep, this is now on our agenda, whereas we've been very much in the past, no, we're not doing it, we're not doing it, we're not doing it, and if that means we don't get your music at all, so be it. They are now saying, perhaps this is something we should be looking at. And the rumour is actually had been considered for Coldplay. They did think, should Coldplay be the first release we do this with? In the end, they didn't. I mean, actually, Coldplay are only windowing off the streaming services for a week. And I suppose that is part of the question. I mean, you could say, well, why is Spotify against this? Because for big name artists, if it means that you're getting the content for your premium users, because I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago when it became clear that Adele was staying off the streaming services with her new record for, well, we don't know how long, but for a few months, presumably at least. And we said, well, the problem with that, I mean, Adele can do whatever Adele likes, but the problem with that is that the people who are paying £10 a month to Spotify, or indeed any of the other premium streaming services, are the record industry's best customers. You know, the reason why the record industry is doing all right at the moment, despite the fact CD sales are going down and download sales are plummeting, is because of those £10 a month subscribers. So in essence, the record industry is saying to its best customers, you can't have our most exciting content. So if Spotify was to have a bit more flexibility on this point, that could stop happening. I mean, perhaps it wouldn't happen with Adele anyway, but who knows? But also, you could say, well, Spotify, more than anyone, wants to turn its free users into premium users. Spotify is losing money on the free users. And obviously, the reason why artists and labels don't like freemium, well, some don't like it because they just don't like the concept of people not having to pay to get their content. Not because they particularly want the money, just sort of the point of principle that it's my new music, you should have to pay to receive it. But also, obviously, Spotify pays much lower royalties on free than it does on premium. So you earn a lot more from a play by a premium user than a freemium user. So the labels and the artists take a hit on freemium, but so does Spotify. I mean, they're losing a lot of money running the freemium service. So you could say, well, surely this is in Spotify's favour too, because if the new Taylor Swift album and the new Coldplay album, and who knows, the new Adele album next time round, 20 years' time, whenever she brings out another album, if they were only available to premium users for a week or a month or 2 months, well, that's a reason for free users to upgrade to premium users. So you could say, actually, this is in Spotify's interest just as much as everybody else. So why have they been so resistant to it?
Because obviously the argument that, you know, freemium upsells premium. Well, if people go on freemium and go, well, this is good, but, oh, I can only access this new Coldplay album if I'm on premium. That's an upsell. That's a reason to buy. I suppose the other argument, which I don't know if Spotify have actually ever explicitly made, is who decides who are the premium artists?
Well, I think that, you know, why have Spotify resisted this so far? Because, I mean, clearly their technology could do it. It's not difficult for their technology to have a tick box when people upload content.
So I think probably they fear everyone doing this.
Yes, and two elements to that is, well, if we say it's premium artists only, who is to decide who are the premium artists? What are our criteria for that? Clearly, Taylor Swift would be in that category. Adele would be in that category. Coldplay would be in that category. But you get middling artists who would maybe say, well, I'm a premium artist. And the politics of that. And the solution to that would be, well, we'll just let the labels decide. Let the labels decide what should and shouldn't be in there. But I suppose if you lost too much new music from the freemium level, they'll Spotify would say, well, you know, how much content can be pulled out of freemium until our free offer becomes completely unattractive and therefore no longer becomes an upsell platform? And I think you can't talk about this without mentioning YouTube.
Yeah.
Because obviously what Spotify would always say is, well, if the new Coldplay album isn't on our free service, none of it can be on YouTube. Because if it's on YouTube and it's not on Spotify free, then it just means that the sorts of people looking for free music will be like, well, screw Spotify free, I'm just going to use YouTube. So almost a condition of this has to be that the label has to be really vigilante on getting the content taken down on YouTube.
They are. Like, I mean, when Taylor Swift was pulling all her music off Spotify, lots of people were going, oh, well, that's all well and good, but, you know, your album's still all over YouTube. It's like people were saying that, but they weren't actually going and looking, because if you searched for that album on YouTube, it was not there. And if you did find it, it disappeared very quickly.
No, and I think, to be fair, certainly the majors and some of the indies, I'm sure, as well. I don't know whether it would be XL doing it on Adele or whether if it was run out of the US, obviously Sony distribute Adele in the US. But now on those big releases and the One Direction releases we've had this year as well, clearly they are doing a very good job of keeping the content off YouTube. And obviously Content ID within YouTube does a certain amount of that automatically. But there are kids out there who know to slightly speed the audio up or play around with it in Audacity in order to make it that Content ID doesn't recognise it. And perhaps Content ID is getting better, but I think it is that they've got a room full of people doing constant metadata checks on the entire YouTube platform, and the minute they see it, it's deleted and taken down. So they are doing that on the big releases. It would be interesting to compare. Is it similarly true for the sort of the middling releases? And my good instinct is you'd probably find the middling releases are not being so prolifically taken down on YouTube because labels are choosing or can't afford to put the same amount of effort in. Yeah. They're just relying on the automated systems. So that might almost be a criteria. You know, you can go premium only, providing you have the will and the resource to keep it off YouTube.
Yeah. But I think also, I think it would work itself out, because I think it's always been the case that there isn't one system that works exactly right for all artists. I think some artists like Taylor Swift and Adele and Coldplay could go premium only, no freemium for however long, 1 week, 3 months, all time. And it wouldn't make much difference to them. However, I think there are some artists who are smaller than that. If they tried windowing, they might find that actually they don't find their audience on Spotify at all. They wouldn't gain the momentum they need because they don't have the visibility of Adele, Taylor Swift and Coldplay. So some artists are quite into the idea of freemium and premium, so wouldn't mind. I think it would just, it would all balance itself out. We'd work out who should be windowed and who shouldn't.
So you seem to be saying, hey, Spotify, go with it.
Yeah.
Try it out.
Why not? I'm pretty sure, although you said ever since the start, I'm certain that back in the old days, when they didn't make such a link between freemium and premium, when they were first out and saying, oh, no, the two things are just completely different. They're not linked at all. Freemium doesn't sell premium.
They're two different services.
They're two different services. And I'm pretty sure they did window things in this way, like a few things. I'm sure there was an Elbow album. Sure of it.
Well, who knows what happened in the past. So anyway, Spotify have been quite non-committal on this when they've asked for official statements. They've not denied it, but they've just said, oh, we're committed to our freemium, blah, blah, blah. But it seems to be that there will be some experiments going on behind the scenes. I mean, perhaps they decided that the massive Coldplay album wasn't, let's not do it on a massive high-profile release. Perhaps they'll do some more sort of low-profile windowing in the new year and introduce it. I mean, in some ways, if we were being cynical for a moment, we do know that some people in the music industry, and Universal in particular as a big rights owner, and some smaller rights owners and some artists, are basically down on freemium generally. They don't like the fact that what we're seeing in streaming is a very small group of people who pay £10 a month. I mean, very small. I mean, there's millions of them, but relatively speaking, very small group of people.
Compared to all people
yes,
who exist.
Compared to all people ever who are paying £120 a year, who are contributing a huge amount of money to the record industry. And then you've got tens and hundreds of millions of people who are accessing the free services, and there's some ad revenue there, but it's not much money. And this is bothering people, even though I keep saying, well, in the 1990s, most people got most of their music on radio.
Yes.
They weren't paying for that. I mean, radio at most was contributing about 3% of the record industry's revenues overall. And then you had a relatively small group of people who bought the CDs. So actually, that isn't really new. It's just that the freemium listening is easier to see online than it is on when it was going through traditional broadcast. But there are plenty of people who are down on freemium. And I think if Spotify were to give on this idea of windowing, it would be a way of placating the freemium critics and maybe shut them up for a year or two without really giving much up. Because as we say, actually, Spotify have got as much to gain out of this beyond the politics of working out how it works.
Well, at least then they'd have these releases on their system rather than, you know, now if you go and, well, it's Friday as this goes out.
New Music Friday.
So Coldplay's album will be on Spotify. But however, if you'd gone to Spotify last week and searched Coldplay's album, you get that screen that comes up. They show you the album with all the tracks and it's sort of greyed out and it says, oh, we're trying to get this on Spotify as soon as possible. We hope the artist realises that you really want to listen to it. And it's all a bit floppy-armed and weak and sounds a bit rubbish. And it makes Spotify look bad. But if it said...
That makes the artist look bad, actually.
Yeah.
So half the people will be like, oh, stupid Spotify, and half the people will be like, stupid Coldplay.
Greedy artist, yeah. Greedy label. Everyone comes out of it looking bad. However, if it said, you can only have this if you pay us £10 a month, then, you know, maybe people still come out of it looking bad. But at least the music's there. And not as many people. I think it's probably more annoying if you're if you're just using it for free and you're getting ads, you'd go, oh, well, I'm not paying anything for this. But as you say, if you're paying £10 a month for it and you go, oh, I want to listen to the new Adele album and it's not there, you're like, well, what am I paying £120 a year for?
So we will see whether or not premium to freemium windowing, that's what I'm calling it, whether or not it will become a reality on Spotify next year. Although the consensus as of this very moment now is that it will start to appear next year, and by this time next year, it could be coming the norm for the big releases. The question is, which artists and how long? But look out for windowing in 2016.
Yes, there was another little bit of Spotify news this week, which was Taylor Swift returned very briefly and credited to the Lost Prophets.
Yes.
that was something that happened.
This was a joker, a hoaxer.
Yes, a hoaxer. Someone tried to get this hoax going on YouTube by putting Taylor Swift's I Knew You Were Trouble up and claiming it was the last song that Lost Prophets recorded, which is a slightly sick hoax. Anyway, when it didn't gain traction, possibly the same person, we don't actually know, but someone took it and put it on Spotify through a distributor. We don't know which distributor because, as Spotify pointed out in their statement on this matter, distributors are supposed to protect Spotify and make sure that the tracks that go on to its service are legal. And this one clearly wasn't, but somehow slipped through the cracks. But it was only up for 3 days.
It was. People noticed and they quickly got it deleted. But
It wasn't just Spotify. It was on Amazon and iTunes and Deezer. Possibly other places, but those are the places that I managed to find it.
So, a little bit of Taylor Swift, albeit with incorrect metadata on the streaming services.
I hope she gets paid for the plays.
I'm sure she will.
European copyright reform now, the most exciting bit of this week's podcast. The European Commission has set out its agenda regarding the reform of copyright rules across Europe as part of its digital single market strategy. Chris, what even is that?
The digital single market strategy. So this is the European Commission trying to evolve both sort of business law and copyright law so that it's easier to do digital stuff online across Europe.
Yeah.
So the European Commission, European Union, doesn't like the fact, that some of the rules that govern things like copyright and the way businesses operate online are different from country to country. So obviously, as is always the way with the European Union, they want to try and harmonise the laws that govern what happens online in a commercial sense. And also the fact that some digital services are available in some parts of Europe but not other parts of Europe is another big part of what they know. The idea is the European Union, it's a free market. You're meant to be able to trade and buy and sell across the entirety of the EU. And online, you have these blocks that exist country to country with sort of IP addresses checked and what you can see. And so it's an attempt by the European Commission to introduce regulations, directives, codes of conduct, and to try and get a little bit more harmonisation with internet stuff online. And a big chunk of this is copyright-based. So this is all linked into to a review of copyright law across Europe. In theory, there is copyright law that exists at a European level, and all the copyright systems in Europe are meant to adjust to fall in line with the European principles, although it doesn't always work. It doesn't help that sort of copyright law here in the UK is quite different to copyright law, certainly in France and Germany. So the European Union puts these sort of rules on top to try and make us all harmonise. But then it's like, the copyright systems to start with are so different, it's really hard to get that harmonisation. So they've been talking about this since the start of the year. And what happened this week was they basically put out a list of their priorities with some information on next steps. So basically what they are planning to do in 2016 about these different issues. So there were very few surprises in this document. We sort of already knew what it was that they were sort of considering and the changes they were going to propose. But it was sort of outlined in a slightly more organised fashion. And as I say, some more specific plans of what's going to happen next.
Yeah, and there were four main things that they laid out. One of the content portability, which is like, so if you're on, you use Netflix in the UK, you go on holiday to Spain.
Which I did.
Which you did. That's why I'm using this example.
To build
that. And then you find that some of the stuff you were watching at home isn't available.
None of it. None of it at all
is available anymore because you've moved countries. And that's a thing that the European Commission wants to get rid of because that's annoying.
Often called geo-blocking. And it's interesting. The various different entertainment industries obviously have been paying a lot of attention to this and lobbying quite hard in Brussels. And the music industry doesn't really have much opinion on geo-blocking. I mean, we do know, actually, Spotify catalogue does vary from country to country. But, I mean, not in the way that the Netflix catalogue varies from country to country. So the music industry is not too bothered about this. But when you talk to the film industry and the TV industry and the e-book industry and the sports industry, this is, for them, the big issue.
And that's why it's top of the list, because they have much better lobbyists than the music industry.
Well, you say that, and then I don't. Well, depends how cynical you are.
They all ganged up together and went, yeah, geo-blocking, and music was just out in the corner going, and safe harbours.
But you say that, the European Commission remains adamant that they're going to fix this and that content portability will become a right as a European citizen by 2017. So however much lobbying they've been doing, the EC is not backing down on this, although there is a line that says that the right to be able to access your Netflix account abroad will be for temporary stays in other countries. And that temporariness, what does that even mean? So I think there is some wiggle room here for the movie industry and the TV industry to sort of try and play around with this. But despite the fact they have been lobbying very hard on this, the EC is still saying content portability will become a right in the European Union by 2017. So in essence, although there is still some wiggle room, they haven't succeeded.
Well, so bad luck. There's also the harmonisation of some copyright exceptions.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's whatever. Ramping up enforcement mainly via, well, the Follow the Money scheme, which started in the UK, whereby rather than trying to chase around after illegal services that pop up and disappear, and actually shutting them down is quite hard, whereas if you go after the people who are giving the money via advertising, that's a lot easier.
So it's something that the City of London Police's IP crime unit,
yes,
which for some reason no one's ever been able to explain to me, is called PIPCU. But it's something they've been doing a lot of work on. So yes, basically, there's a piracy site. Oh, look, they have Google Ads or similar. Well, let's just go to Google Ads and make sure they're not allowed it. Or we go to all the advertisers and say, do you know you're advertising on a piracy site? Or some of those sites take donations or they have a subscription service. So you go to Visa and MasterCard and PayPal and cut it off. Obviously, it doesn't work for services like the Pirate Bay, which aren't really run for profit. So it doesn't work for those where they're just set up to share content and nobody really trying to make any money. But it can be quite effective, and you're right. The EC is going to have a code of conduct to sort of campaign for more of these initiatives across the EU. And they did say that if these voluntary codes they're going to introduce don't work, then they might even legislate on this. Although generally the ad industry and the sort of the credit card industry have been very supportive of this. But that will be going EU-wide.
And then there's the clarification of the making available right.
So we're not going to talk much about this today. Perhaps we'll come back to it on another day. But this is the one that the artist and performer community will be particularly on. You briefly mentioned safe harbours. So as far as the record companies and the music publishers and the collecting societies are concerned, the thing that they want changed in this review of copyright law is the so-called safe harbour rules, which is how YouTube can operate as an opt-out rather than an opt-in streaming service. So YouTube can let its users upload a load of content and it's for the rights owners to then remove it. And the reason YouTube can get away with that system is because of these safe harbours. The music industry doesn't like that. They say that gives YouTube an unfair advantage over a Spotify, and they want that to be reformed. Safe harbours are not a key priority of the EC in this document, although under the fighting piracy bit, they do talk about the responsibilities of intermediaries, YouTube's an intermediary online, to help in the fight against piracy. So there is, again, a few lines in there that the labels and the publishers can use to continue fighting for safe harbours. But actually for artists and songwriters, although they too probably want the reform of safe harbours, this idea of the making available right, there isn't time to go in it. Do you know what you should do? Get yourself a copy of the Dissecting the Digital Dollar Report, because we explain it all in there. And this is basically to do with how digital income is split between labels and publishers and recording artists and songwriters, and particularly the split of the money between labels and featured artists and session musicians. And it's really interesting that this is very much on the agenda in the European Commission. It's great news for the Featured Artists Coalition and for their global equivalent, and they will continue to lobby hard on this issue in 2016. So I'm not saying any more about it now, but we'll almost certainly come back to this in the new year, because I think this is going to be one of the big things in terms of copyright lobbying in 2016. And that is all I have to say about the European Copyright Review. CMU approved time now. And because you insisted that I talk about our Christmas dinners at the start of the podcast, we're running out of time. So you're going to have to do this super fast.
Okay.
And tell us about Nick nicely.
Yes. Well, Nick, I should say this is the last standard run of approved artists of the year. Next week, we'll be running through our five favourite artists of the year. So it'll be people you've heard of.
Rather than new approveds. But Nick Nicely is not one of our artists of the year.
No,
but he is one of our approvees.
He is, and he's someone who we've approved before. And this is the third single off the same album that he was approved for last time, but actually it was a good year ago. So it was time to bring him back. London South is the new single. It's been released with two new remixes from Grasscut and Abel Mogard, who both take very different reimaginings of the song. It's kind of, I think it's called psychedelic. He's a bit like, I don't know, he's a bit almost a warped Kinks. I think that it's quite a, he doesn't sound like the Kinks, you shouldn't assume that, but that was...
He does sound warped.
I've got a little bit of that in it. Anyway, next.
The Response.
The Response, they're from New Zealand. They've self-released three albums in New Zealand, and then they moved to Canada, which is, I think, the standard. That's what you do after three albums, is move to Canada.
That's what I'm going to do after I've released my three albums.
Now they're working on their fourth. And this track that I proved you wanted to go is the first track from that fourth album. It's kind of a very floaty synth track. It leaves a lot of space for their vocals, which cover lyrics about unrealised dreams, which you could argue, what do they know about unrealised dreams? They've gone and moved to Canada.
Well, perhaps their dream was to
stay in New Zealand.
To stay in New Zealand or move
maybe,
somewhere.
Maybe.
To Malaysia, perhaps. Mm. So are we going with Sophia or Sophia?
Sophia? Why would it be Sophia?
Well, I know someone called Sophia.
No, you don't.
Sophia Samajo? Samajo?
Yeah, fine.
Yeah.
I don't actually know.
Tell us about Sophia.
She's been releasing music for a number of years under the name So-So.
Would have been a lot easier, frankly.
Which would have been a lot easier. However, I think So-So is not a name that sells you.
Well, you know, managing expectations. you're going to be pleasantly surprised when you're told this is So-So.
You would, because her music is very good. This is the second single after her slight rebrand, which is taken from an EP that's coming out next February. She's Scandinavian, so it's very good pop. One more, I don't need to say any more.
Not need to say any more, which is just as well, because time is against us. Chloe.
She used to perform music under her own name, so the reverse of Sophia Samajo. Her name is Chloe Latimer. She used to perform kind of acoustic singer-songwriter stuff. And then I read an interview with her where she basically says, I felt like I outgrew that and wanted to do something different. And now she's doing pop, and she's doing very well at it. She released the first single she released came out in December last year, and then there was another one early this year, just kind of self-released, put up on SoundCloud, that she'd written and produced with Lewis Gardner from Prides. And then she got whisked off to LA. She went and worked with producers and writers out there, signed to IAM Sound, and now she is back with her first single after doing all that, which is called Touch. It sort of has the same teenage love and relationships themes of her other singles. It's all tied in together, but it's very, you know, the stuff before was good. This is a spruced up version of it. And I think we'll be hearing more of her in 2016.
So that's it for CMU Approved for 2015. Nothing else will be approved by the CMU office this year.
Other than five more artists who...
Yes, but that's a more retrospective thing.
Yes, it is. These are all looking ahead. We're going to look back a little bit next week.
And the CMU Approved will return in 2016, maybe with a little new luck. What could be new luck about CMU Approved in 2016?
I don't know. We'll approve different animals.
I think rather...
First animal of 2016 will be the badger.
So completemusicupdate.com/approved to find out more.
Time to get mysterious on the podcast now as we talk about the Agent of Change. What is the Agent of Change?
Well, Agent of Change is a principle which has been increasingly advocated by the sort of the grassroots live sector in recent months and last year, really. So we talked about Music Venues Day. I can't remember whether there's an S.
Venue Trust.
Yeah, so the Music Venue Day and the Music Venues Trust.
No, other way around.
Or whichever way around it is.
I think, actually. Wait.
No, let's not wait. We don't have time to wait. I've been talking about this as well. And, of course, Martin Elbun, founder of The Great Escape, also spoke about it at The Great Escape.
I think we've talked about it on this very podcast.
Because The Great Escape happened just after the general election. And he was saying, this is something that the new government should look into. So, basically, this is a principle that aims to overcome that really irritating thing that has seemed to have happened with increased regularity. I don't know if it's just that we're more aware of these things than we used to be. I don't know. But that thing where you have a rundown part of town, and then there's a music venue. And it may be that the music venue's new. It may well be the music venue's been there for 20 years. Whatever. It makes that part of town feel a bit more funky, and so it all gets a bit more trendy, and people start to move in. And then property developers arrive, and the warehouse next to the music venue, they say, I could convert that into really expensive apartments and piggyback on the back of this fact this is a sort of a vibrant, arty place now. And I'll sell each of those apartments for £2 million. And then these rich people move into these apartments at £2 million a pop, and they say... it's really annoying that there's this noisy venue next door in this vibrant, arty, cultural part of town. And they then complain to the council, and the council come along to the venue and say, you're too noisy. And the venue say, well, we've been here. We're no more noisy than we were 10 years ago. Those guys moved in. For God's sake, why did they move in next to a venue? But then the councils are prone to say, no, you need to either turn the volume down or put soundproofing in. And it's like, well, if we turn the venue down, that screws us. No one will want to come here anymore. Most grassroots venues operate on incredibly tight profit margins. The thought of having to put the soundproofing in and possibly shut the venue for 2 months while you do all that renovation, there's no way a venue can afford it. And we have seen some venues either really cut back, and so they can't do as many gigs and shows as a result of this, or indeed going out of business. And so the idea of the agent of change is, if you are an agent of change, i.e. you are the property developer coming in and changing a building into a residential property, it is your responsibility to ensure that that issue doesn't come up. And if it means, it may mean soundproofing the building that you are developing, or it might mean going to the venue next door and saying, all right, then we will pay for you to be soundproofed. And if that means you have to shut for a month, we will cover the cost of you being shut for a month and we will put it right, so that once we have posh people moving into our £2 million apartments, that is not going to be an issue. And so that's basically what the agent of change principle is. It already exists in Australia. And as I say, various people, the MU, the Musicians Union, have also been quite hot on this, have been saying that this is something that we should have every year. We all know grassroots venues are struggling for all sorts of reasons, and this will be one way to help the grassroots music community and those little live venues here in the UK. So that's what the principle is. Why don't you, Andy Malt, tell us why we're talking about it?
Well, we're talking about it this week because, as you said, lots of people said, hey, new government that's just come in, you should have a look at this. And did they? No, they did not. However, it has now been put on the table by two Labour MPs, Shadow Culture Minister Michael Duggar and John Healey. It's now at the committee stage.
Yes, so what they did was they spotted that there is actually planning legislation going through Parliament. So planning law is being reformed, so there is relevant legislation going through Parliament. The government didn't think about this, so they're, as it goes through, as a committee stage in the House of Commons, and so they are seizing on the opportunity of saying, well, hang on a second, we've got legislation about sort of planning and property development going through Parliament anyway. This is a perfect opportunity to insert a few lines to introduce this agent of change principle. And so they put it on the table this week.
Yep, and it was very well received by lots of people in the music industry. UK Music, the Music Venue Trust and the Musicians Union all said, very good. Very good indeed.
Add this, some other trade bodies that I couldn't be bothered. So it was one of those press releases with so many quotes in it that I didn't actually run them all. I think the Association of Independent Festivals were also behind it.
Yes, they were, yes. And lots of people, when we tweeted a link out to this story, lots of people were responding. Saying,
about time!
About time. This is great news. So it's clearly a popular proposal amongst, well, people in music.
I suppose what's interesting is, what do the property developers think? Obviously, this is a opposition amendment to a piece of legislation going through Parliament, so it's by no means in the law as yet. It remains to be seen whether there is opposition on the government side in the Commons. I imagine it would probably go through the Lords, okay. But we will see whether or not the property... Obviously, ultimately, this is asking property developers to spend money. And property developers don't like having to spend money that they don't have to spend. So there could be opposition, there could be a lobby on that side trying to get this either deleted entirely, or as sort of happened with the when the live industry managed to get secondary ticketing rules sneaked into the Consumer Rights Bill earlier this year. It gets watered down to such an extent that actually it's not worth having. But that hasn't happened yet. And all the music industry organisations are coming up saying, yeah, this is a good thing, everyone should support this. So it remains to be seen, as that legislation works its way through Parliament, whether or not it gets through to the final act.
Yeah, it does also say that, you know, if it gets through, this would have applied to new music venues as well. It's not just property developers. It might be that they've worded it with that particular opposition in mind, that if you're setting up a new music venue, you have to ensure that it's been soundproofed properly and it's not going to be too loud and it's not going to annoy people nearby.
Yeah, which cuts sort both
of
ways.
Which is sort of the case already.
But well, normally, because normally to open a live music venue, you need to get a licence, and part of the licence application process would be that, and locals would have an opportunity. But yes, the principle would be expressed, so it does cut both ways. So it's not just anti-property developers in favour of venues. But, I mean, I think it would be really interesting to see what response there is to this. And if it does get through, it will then be really interesting to see how it works and if it does genuinely have a positive impact. But certainly various people in the live industry think that it really could. So one to watch is another or ones to watch, which are not artists. What was it last week? It was lawsuits to watch in 2016. This week it is legislative reforms to watch.
Which is not as interesting sounding.
I'm going to put these into a list and get everyone talking about them on social media. I'm sure people will be really interested in that.
Everyone loves a list.
Everyone loves a list.
Just time to very quickly scoot through, and very quickly, because you talked about the cold turkey that you were on. I wasn't really listening. What were you saying?
That sounds like... Given that I was talking on Facebook earlier this week about how I've not had a fizzy drink in a year, and someone said, oh, I'm glad that you've managed to kick your Coke addiction, and now you're talking about me talking about cold turkey. If people only half listen to what I say,
all I know
really
is that Chris
impression.
Cook has turned up to this podcast recording very drunk, and he's on cold turkey, and I forget what else you were saying. Anyway, happy birthday.
It's not my birthday.
Happy birthday has been settled, the lawsuit around it.
Yes, so this
is boring.
This is, obviously, we talked about this at length on a recent podcast about how that whether or not Happy Birthday, which is controlled by Warner Chappell, whether or not it is still in copyright. This is quite a big development this week, although we've not talked about it in any great detail, because it's a big development in that Warner Chappell and the people who were suing to try and get it confirmed that Happy Birthday is actually public domain, not protected by copyright. All the parties have settled, but that's all we know.
Yeah, the question of whether Warner Chappell actually owns it hasn't really been answered.
Well, we know they don't own it, but what we don't know is there a copyright to own? And if there is, who owns it? So, although all sources seem to think that the conclusion of this settlement will be that Happy Birthday will cease to be in copyright in the US, although we don't know what that means for all the people who've paid to use it for the last 60 years. Outside of the US, here in Europe, it is still in copyright. That is not up for debate. Although, if Warner Chappell don't own the copyright, well, who does own the copyright? So, big development this week in this story, but because actually we don't really know what that settlement says, we don't really know what that's going to mean, I'm assuming they've got 10 days to fully give the information to court. So I reckon they'll do it in the next week. So we may come back to this on next week's podcast.
Talking of settling, Aorus, it's the shortest-lived digital music service of all time.
It is. I mean, in terms of all of the many piracy battles that the music industry has had over the last 15 years, I'm writing a book about them. Have I told you that? I'm going to write about all these different piracy battles. I've already started it.
Have you?
It's very exciting. But I mean, this is the short... I mean, normally when a piracy service pops up, even if the music industry are on it quite quickly, which actually usually they're not. Normally it takes them a year to notice. But even if they're on it quite quickly, traditionally it would take 2, 3, 4 years to go through all the legal motions and to ultimately shut the service down. And this all happened in the space of about 6 weeks.
Well, basically, yeah, Aorus launched. The RIAA issued a lawsuit. They agreed to take it down. There was a bit of a kerfuffle about some code that appeared. And now they've agreed to pay $3 million in damages. It is, like you say, like 6 weeks. How did that happen?
And it was only live for about, I mean, where these damages come from? It was live for, what, 3 days? And okay, I suppose once it's out there on the internet, it's out there on the internet. But I mean, it was shut down before, and it was launched in alpha. I mean, never even got to beta. So the speed of this is quite impressive. And obviously the RIAA, I wish they would have an acronym that was easier to say. See this, I think, as setting precedent, that if you even just begin a startup that is based on a piracy business or an allegedly piracy business, then you will be slammed down immediately and there could be some costs to pay, some significant costs to pay on the bill to that. So, hey, Mr. Startup Developer, don't even think about it, I think, is what they were hoping to get out of this case. And perhaps they will, who knows?
SFX still having some financial problems, but hoping that Cream founder James Barton is going to come and save them.
Cream the clubbing brand rather than Cream the band.
Yeah.
So, yes, James Barton set up Cream and Creamfield. He is currently electronic music chief, whatever that means, at Live Nation, because Live Nation bought Cream a few years ago. But rumour has it that SFX are trying to nab him. We don't quite know what his job title would be, whether or not he would basically be running the business and Robert Silliman, the founder, would take a back seat. We don't know. But in an attempt to mend SFX. So we'll see whether or not that rumour comes true.
Elastic Artists got their social media stuff back and basically shut them down.
So that we talked about that a lot last week.
Yes.
That's resolved. Well, the social media bit of it's resolved.
The financial problems bit of it, not so much.
We still think the company is in administration, but we're waiting for official word on that.
There's also a new CEO at the MMF.
Or there
Music
will be.
Music Managers Forum. Yes, there will be in January.
On the 1st of January. So Music Managers Forum. So John Webbo Webster, who has run the MMF for quite a long time now. 7 years, eight years?
8 years, I think.
8 years. So the trade body for music managers have a new CEO. Actually, Webbo is still going to be working there in a... he's taking the job title president, because basically he's sort of going to be there and he'll take on various projects and sort of be there in an advisory role. But he did say to me that all the job titles he could think of that would properly describe what he was doing were the sort of pretentious job titles that we would mock in CMU. So he's gone for the title of president. But I think the new appointment is interesting, because the new appointment isn't an artist manager. doesn't even have a sort of, you know, obviously Weber used to work in record companies, doesn't really have a music industry background, has a lobbying background, so a public affairs background. And I think that's a real statement from the MMF. The Featured Artists Coalition has become a much more serious lobbying organisation this last year. I think the MMF are going to do the same next year. And in some ways, this is the artists and their managers wanting to have a front seat whenever government, whether it's Brussels, Westminster or Washington, are considering music issues. They want artists and managers to be up there up front, whereas perhaps traditionally the labels and the publishers have tended to have a bigger voice in political circles. And sometimes labels and publishers, artists and songwriters agree, and sometimes they don't agree. So that will be interesting to see what impact that has.
Yep, so go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast and you'll find the show notes for this show and all of our shows. But you'll be able to find links to read all of those stories in full.
And finally,
the Wu-Tang Clan. They sold that single copy album they
were
making.
Explain that, just in case people haven't been paying attention.
So last year, they recorded, the surviving original members of the Wu-Tang Clan recorded a new album called Once Upon a Time in Shaolin, which is notable because they then only pressed one copy of it, put it in a box and said, we're going to only make one copy of this album and we'll sell it to the highest bidder. So.
And I think it was almost a statement, wasn't it, that in the digital age, music is everywhere and sort of music seems to have lost its value. So we're going to have one copy, one recording of this, and that will be the only copy ever made, and we're going to sell it for lots of money. And the original plan was to, we talked about this on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, that the original plan was to do an art installation, that they would tour the galleries of the world. I don't quite know what the visual bit was going to be, but
you'd look at the box.
You'd look at the box,
it's and you quite could, a nice box,
and you could listen to the music. And they were going to do that in various galleries, and then sell it to one collector. Although in the end, they only did one of them.
It wasn't even an art gallery. I think it was just in a venue.
So for some reason, they did it once, and then they were selling it. Then it all sort of went quiet, and we didn't really know what was happening with it. And then it was about a month ago, wasn't it, that suddenly they said, "Oh, we've sold it.
I think it was about a week ago.
I think 2 weeks ago. I reckon we talked about it on not last podcast, but the podcast before.
Yeah, you're right.
We were wearing headphones talked about it.
Weeks ago, you're right, yes. We were in this room, I remember. We don't need to talk about through the admin of this. We're running out of time.
But the point is that when they originally said it had been sold, it was sold to an anonymous bidder. And apparently that they'd agreed to buy it a few months ago, but it had taken a while to agree the contracts. But the contracts had now been signed and the box was being handed over. What happened this week
is that the anonymous bidder was unmasked.
And it turns out we all knew of the anonymous bidder.
Yeah, it turned out it was Martin Scraley, who you may know.
Remind us who he is.
He is the person who made many a headline recently by buying the rights to a drug that's used to treat AIDS and cancer and then ramping up the price 5,000%.
So he's a hedge fund manager, so he made his money in the city. And it's hard to know, isn't it? Because obviously you'd never heard of this guy or seen the guy before that acquisition and the ramping up the price of these drugs we've only seen. But he does have one of the most slappable faces I've ever seen. And you're sort of like, I just can't help thinking, even if I hadn't known this story, there's just something about him that's really irritating to look at.
Well, there is that, yeah. But we also know that he's got lots of money. We also know, actually, he's got an interest in music because at the time he was making headlines before, it turned out he was the main investor in Collect Records, which is owned by Thursday frontman Jeff Rickley.
Which had gone through a weird, rapid expansion a couple of years ago.
It had suddenly gone from being sort of a kind of bedroom, not quite serious label to suddenly being quite a serious label. And then it turned out that was because this guy was pumping them full of money.
And once the scandal erupted, various artists signed to it were like, oh my God, I can't believe that we're basically living off that dude's money. And they all threatened to sort of pull. Yeah. And in the end, the label, I mean, we felt really sorry for the guy. I mean, I don't know whether he knew quite this guy's attitude to the world when he took his money, but he basically handed the money back, didn't he, and cut him out of the label.
He just said, right, well, if it's a choice between keeping my artists or keeping the money, I will keep the artist. But now I'm not really sure what happens to the artist. I mean, it might be that the label's now expanded enough that they can sustain it without
slappable face guy's money.
We'll see. Anyway, his interest in music is known, and possibly we should have guessed that it was him who'd bought this album. But anyway, now, so Bloomberg published an article this week outing him, with an interview with him talking about it. So it's not like he was not wanting to be outed. But he did do this deal before it all blew up about his ramping up drug prices. But he did say in this interview that he was worried that although the deal was done in principle in May, he was a little bit worried that Wu-Tang were going to come along and go, no, we don't like you, we don't want your money. That didn't happen.
I suppose it's interesting, A, the fact that it did took several months to do the contract. Was that just, I mean, we discovered there are some interesting clauses in the contract, which we could talk about in a moment, but was it partly because they did have second thoughts? Who knows? Also, you know, the fact that they didn't reveal the identity of the buyer.
The auction house, I mean, the Bloomberg went to the auction house as well for confirmation, I think, that it was definitely him that bought the album, and the auction house said we'd never reveal who our buyers are. That said, both the buyer and the seller can quite happily reveal the name as much as they like, and Wu-Tang Clan didn't choose to do that.
But since we found out that this bastard has bought this record, Wu-Tang have issued a statement trying to play the, well, we gave some of the money to charity card.
Yeah, well, RZA, the, I guess, leader of the Wu-Tang Clan, he said in a statement to Bloomberg, the sale of Once Upon a Time in Shaolin was agreed upon in May, well before Martin Scraley's business practices came to light. We decided to give a significant portion of the proceeds to charity.
So one would hope a charity that helps people who are desperately in need of this drug that they can no longer afford and so they're dying. Who knows? Once this became to light and we knew who had bought it, then who was it who... I don't quite know how they got a copy of the contract.
The contract seems to be floating around. I've seen various people
quoting it. So there was one particular clause. So he now has it. He's bought it. The transaction's gone through. Wu-Tang have the money. They've given some of it away. He hasn't listened to it yet, he said.
He hasn't listened to it yet. He's saving it for a rainy day. Unless Taylor Swift phones up and says that she wants to listen to it with him, in which case he would be willing to do that, he said.
In a really horrible, smarmy way.
But no, he's not listened to it yet. Obviously, he had a private listening session a little while ago, so he has heard it. But
he only did that because he got to hang out with RZA.
No, he got to hang out with RZA after.
Oh, that
when
after
he,
that.
When he said he wanted to buy it, that was when he
That's
had lunch.
That's when he got the lunch.
Anyway, so the contract blocks him. He's not allowed to commercially release the album for 88 years. But so there's this big contract that lists all kind of things, like the fact that he's buying it for $2 million. He can't release it commercially for 88 years. He can release it for free, and he can hold listening parties, though I assume that he's not going to do that.
Unless Taylor Swift's
also
available.
The most interesting clause, which I've now seen in a couple of places, is that it says that the Wu-Tang Clan are allowed to take the album back via a heist or caper, which can legally be carried out by either the group themselves or Bill Murray. Which, I mean, if I was writing a contract, that's the sort of thing I would like to put in.
But they can only have one attempt.
Yes, one attempt in 88 years.
So they can't be doing a heist every week till they get it. So it would have to be a very
so
well-planned
heist. So they've got till 2103 to carry out this heist or caper.
And if Bill... Can they both do it? Could it be the Wu-Tang Clan and Bill Murray? I quite like to... That would be a good film, actually.
I think it's or. So I think it would be a
one
breach of
other.
Contract if they did it together.
That's a shame,
I'm not sure.
It?
Is there a legal definition of caper?
Well, I'd have to go through the case law and see what the constraints are of that clause. So although this guy that we all hate has the record, there's that slight glimmer of hope that
Bill Murray might take it
well,
back from
you
him.
Know, on that rainy day when he finally gets around to listening to it, perhaps it will be a sort of rainy day where Bill Murray will be sitting at home thinking, it's a bit boring, isn't it? I know, I'm going to go and stage a heist and get that Wu-Tang record back. So this story could as yet have a comedic and entertaining ending. But anyway, there you go.
Well, I guess that's the end of this week's podcast.
It is.
What is the legal definition of a caper? Let us know at CMU on Twitter, rather than having to look through loads of documents.
I know some lawyers do listen to this podcast.
Yeah, so
if you
could tweet us and let us know.
Some detailed,
that would be really
legally binding responses.
Don't forget, of course, you can subscribe to get this podcast delivered right to you every week.
And you
for
can
free.
Share. This is not a one-off. We're not saying that only you are allowed a copy of this podcast. We could do that next year. Like, we could do one edition of the podcast that only one person's allowed. But this podcast, share it. You can share it with as many people as you like.
It is free to listen to and to share.
Yeah.
I mean, so you could get two things for free there, and that is worth having.
And invite Taylor Swift over to listen to it. We don't care. So share and share alike.
I think Taylor Swift likes to listen alone to our podcast.
Does she?
That's what I've
heard. So she can properly concentrate.
Anyway, it was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook.
The podcast, that is.
Yeah, not Taylor Swift. This podcast that you are listening to now, so I have to state everything so that everyone can understand, including drunk Chris Cook. Did you say clearly at the beginning that you don't drink?
I don't think I did.
Chris doesn't drink. That's why I keep repeating that he's drunk. No one's listening to this bit. Everyone's already switched off and they think you're drunk.
On non-cold turkey. So yeah. That's good. It's good.
Anyway.
We won't be invited back to the British Institute of Music Madness now. Now they've heard all of this.
Anyway, I'm Andy Bolt. He's Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And more CMU stuff you'll find at completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
I think, was that 7 hours?